sales versus operations. It's a constant battle. How does operations support sales, and what's more important, sales or operations? And the reality is, operations become somewhat of a cornerstone to the sales process. Does your store look good, smell good, feel good? And does your team have the discipline to maintain operations without question? And it's from that discipline that you're able to hold people accountable for their selling process or their customer engagement. Harry, in today's podcast, I was hoping you could address something I keep reading in a lot of our content, and that is operations versus sales. It's almost like they're enemies, or they're competing against each other. What is your take on operations versus sales, and why do you actually relay that in this sort of, you know, competitive environment?
Justin, how you doing today, Justin?
Look, I'm excited. I'm recording podcasts. I get to talk to you, which is very rare, you know. So I'm doing really well, all things considered.
All things considered.
All things considered.
That's a PBS radio show.
Isn't it? Yeah.
All right. Well, it is a fight. It's a fight, man. It's a fight. The operators versus the sellers. It's a fight. So let's strip this down, because there is an endpoint to this conversation, and it puts things into perspective very, very well. And I have no problem wanting to share this with you. So if you were to take all the people out of a store and just be left with the store, the merchandise, the back room, all the stuff, the cash register and everything else, you would be introduced to operations. People are sales, right? The actual humans that work in the store. And I have to tell you that operations work perfectly so long as you never open the store doors. If you don't open the doors, the store runs like a clock. So let's tear it apart. It's the way I look at things. I promise you, I look at this all the time. In my vision, there's some walls. Yes, and then there's furniture, fixtures, and all that. Mm-hmm. There's a layout to the back room, racks, all that stuff. There's a bathroom. There's a cash wrap area. There's all these things, and we actually, you know, we affix them to the wall or put racks in, all that stuff, and we actually get it to the point where we're pretty satisfied that this is the way we want the store to look at that moment in time, right? Things change. You move things around, for sure. You don't move shelving around as much as you do racks and things like that, but yeah, whatever, to whatever degree you move things around, that's fine. But there's always that vision. So the minute the hard racking and shelving and, you know, all that stuff is done, that's the vision, that's the way it should be. And if you were to just take a look at it, you would say, okay, what's the condition of all this stuff? And everybody goes, well, it looks pretty good. I mean, there's no big gashes in the wood, and there's no smudges on the paint, and, you know, it looks really, really, really nice. And then we go ahead and we say, all right, well, let's go ahead and get let's go get some merchandise, and we have a selection of merchandise, and we arrange it on all those racks and shelves and things, and it looks beautiful. There's either a planogram or somebody with some experience from the visual merchandising department or an owner or manager. Somebody knows how they want it to look and really, really get it nice. And there's signage, and then there's toilet paper, right? You've got toilet paper. You've got extra tape for the POS or ERP system. And, you know, you have a checklist of all the things that you need to operate. Correct?
Correct.
So it was perfect. And my question to you is, well, first of all, and then in my world, we take a set of about 10 or 20 or 30 pictures of it exactly right and put that in a book. And we say, that's the way the store looks. And it becomes the standard. And everything below that is below standard. and it's almost hard to get above standard. Who cares? Just get it to standard. And once you have that, what you have is a store that looks really, really great. You have all the merchandise that is organized and looks really, really terrific. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the best you can do. Now, I mean, are there some people that would come along and say, well, I wouldn't have put that stuff there, or I would do it this way, or I would have, who cares? I mean, in the end of the day, your company says, that's the best I can do. That's the way I'd like it to be. Now, who in the world issues a memo that says, well, once you kick in half the racks and carpets have big stains on them and get worn out and the cash wrap area looks a little wonky with pen marks on the countertop, and you know, when did the company issue a memo that that's cool to actually devalue the assets of the company? Oh my goodness. I mean, I go out of my mind.
It's just laziness, right?
Oh, I don't, you know, laziness is part of it. It's really not laziness. It's really the vision and the standards that the manager has, really, isn't it? Not lazy. The people will do it if that's required, and the managers doesn't really want to talk about it. I don't know why managers are willing to talk about how a store gets debilitated. I don't know why they're willing to talk about it. I'm not. It's like keep it perfect or just get out. I'm relentless about this. And there's two reasons. You walk into a store that's on top of their game in terms of the assets of the store, the merchandise, the displays, and everything else, and I swear to God, you can smell it. You can feel it. I always thought that, you know, the limited organization did such a good job with all this stuff. You walk into a Gap, or you walk in, and that's different, but you walk into a Victoria's Secret, or you walk into, you know, some of these stores, limited, it just felt good. Don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah. They set it up beautifully. Yeah.
I mean, they're really, really nice. The merchandise folded all the time. They just look great. Lighting is bright and reflective. It's just beautiful. I love walking into some of these stores. Shelves are faced off. The merchandise, it just looks great. There's no empty shelves. They just figure it out. Forget about the selling part of this, but operationally, you could just smell it. And then you walk into some of these other stores, and you almost want to put one of these, you know, masks on your face and with long sleeve shirts, because you're going to get the cooties in some of these stores. It's just miserable to me. Where does that come from? Well, I don't know. First of all, I think it has to do with awareness, doesn't it? First and foremost, somebody's not aware that these things are important.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. They're just not aware. Anyway, I have a philosophy that I like my stores perfect. I don't need to spend a whole bunch of time on it, because the minute something goes a little bit haywire, we fix it immediately. We don't wait. It doesn't accumulate until it becomes this impossible thing to fix. Bathrooms are perfect. Everything is perfect. You know, I'll tell you a little side story, Justin. Over these many decades of being out there in the field and consulting with retailers, I've developed, and I'm kind of letting the cat out of the bag, but I always developed this little habit. I'd walk into a store on a store visitation. I'd say, excuse me, do you have a restroom I could use? And the purpose was for me to see what the bathroom looked like. And that was all I ever needed to know about the discipline in this organization. If the bathroom was perfect and anybody was comfortable going in there, men, women, kids. I mean, it was absolutely stunningly clean and perfect and healthy looking and all that kind of stuff. I said, sales increases are going to be a little tougher in this organization. But if I walked into a disaster area, I go, oh boy, oh baby, this is going to be easy. I already have a 25% increase in sales in mind, because they're an undisciplined, sloppy organization.
The bathroom test. The bathroom test determines 20% increase in revenue.
At least. I swear to God, listen, I've done this a lot of times. Ask any one of my senior consultants, they'll tell you, the bathroom test, that's one of Harry's greatest. That'll absolutely tell you what kind of an increase you're going to get for this client. So just you, that simple. Not the main office. Don't look at that. You got to go to a store.
I hope all gas stations are listening to this podcast right now. You hear that? 20% increases in sales, gas stations. Yeah.
Well, you know, that's kind of funny. I live in Central California now, and I drive to LA a lot, you know, for things. And I run out of gas, or I start to run out of gas around a certain kind of a place on the journey. And I always stop at this one place. Why? Because it's absolutely stunning. I mean, it's a gas station, kind of a convenience store, and bathrooms are glorious. The actual store itself is really beautifully merchandised, and people are friendly. And, you know, I give them my gas, you know, I give them my $500 gas money, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think much about it, but and it's funny, my mind takes me there every time. I don't even think about it, and I always get off the freeway in the same place. Anyway, the biggest thing about keeping the store in this magnificent level was a discovery of mine. Because I became fascinated. Now, this is really kind of cool. I became fascinated with military novels, you know, CIA, covert operations, black ops, you know, Navy SEALs, CIA. You know, if somebody didn't get killed in the first chapter, I went on to another book. But I particularly love the SEALs and read a lot about them. And there's a reason for this, and it actually, interestingly enough, has nothing to do with the idea of war, you know, any of those things. But I started reading about a guy that would a little squad leader that was taking 6 18-year-olds into the jungles in Vietnam, and my question was, what did this guy say to get these guys to go, and why did they go, and what kind of leadership involves all that, and how does this all work? And I just saw it all as management. I know this sounds ridiculous, but the United States military does this magnificent job of moving people around and getting them trained and organized. During Desert Storm, we moved 500,000 people to the Middle East. It's incredible. The logistics alone of moving 500,000 people halfway around the world. That's what fascinated me. And now, at the time, we were handling the United States Marine Corps and doing all the sales training for the Army Air Force Exchange Services. So if you went into a retail store on one of these bases, it was likely that the guy was being going through sales training from the Friedman Group, which I thought was it was really kind of fun. And I talked to these guys, some of the captains and majors that worked in the retail organization, and they were saying, look, these guys go over there. There's a population of 5,000, 10,000 people in a particular camp and all that. We have retail stores for them to buy things. We don't give them everything. You know, we give them their outfit and we feed them, but they buy their own deodorant and shaving supplies and all that, and we have to give them a selection, and we set up stores. Of course, they do have a captured audience, and conversion rates very high. But I was fascinated by the logistics of all this stuff. And the further I read, and the more I got interested in how the process works, one inevitably gets back to boot camp, where it all starts. And I know that you didn't serve, and I didn't serve, but I certainly have nothing but admiration for the people that do. I love them to death. But you think about this. They get these guys up at 5 o'clock in the morning. They make them make their bed to within an inch of its life. They make them shine their shoes. You know, nowadays I don't even think they have those shiny shoes, but they shine the shoes, you know, your buckle. You've seen all these movies where they do all that stuff.
Yeah, of course.
And they get them out on the line. And then they march like hell, you know, in perfect formation. And this is what it's all about in boot camp. So one has to wonder what's the end game here, and the answer is 100% pure unadulterated discipline. They want to know, when they tell a guy to do something, he's going to do it. And they tell him to do something for his benefit. I mean, if you're in the middle of a war zone and you tell your guys to duck, I mean, do you want to have a conversation about this or do you just want to duck?
I'd like to duck.
Yeah. And so you're trained to duck without thinking about it. We can fight about it later, but right now let's duck, right? Or if we say, take this hill, go do this, the guys comply, right? And they just get it done and they love it. There's teamwork, camaraderie, they're going towards a common goal. And the lesson I kept learning over and over and over again and drilling on things, they drill until it becomes second nature. And I just fell in love with this concept. And I said, well, wow, how does that relate to my retail? And it relates 100%. The idea of operational discipline becomes the manifesto of running a great retail organization. Look, you can walk up to the sergeant and say, hey, sergeant, I just want to talk to you for a second here. Listen, if we got up at 6 instead of 5, and you know, our beds weren't made all that well and shoes weren't all that shiny, do you think we would kill less of the enemy that way? It's like, yeah, well, I don't know that the getting up at 5, the bed and the shoes ever had anything to do with being successful in battle. Other than the fact that we had a disciplined organization. And without discipline, no organization can grow to its potential, without any doubt. So I use the store's cleanliness and organization as a metaphor for discipline and actual discipline in order to be free, in order to be free to think about customer service and selling. And so that's why it was always operations versus sales. So let's take Walmart, for example. I mean, those are big stores, correct?
I mean they're not small. Yeah, no. Walmart's a huge store.
Of course they are.
Of course.
And for the most part, they're pretty darn well merchandised, aren't they? I mean, yeah, the shelves look pretty good. You know, the aisles are clean, the floor looks pretty spick and span. Yeah, you know, this is no critique on the merchandise they have or their overall merchandising scheme, but for the few times that I go into Walmart, I find them to be, you know, cleanliness, merchandise, quite delightful. Now, you can up the game and you can go into a Bass Pro Shop. We've talked about them before, mm-hmm. right? That'll blow your brains out, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have a grocery chain in when I used to live in Los Angeles called Gelson's, and it's actually a very expensive grocery market. It's on the, I'm not so sure whether they're more expensive than Whole Foods or not, but it's way up there in the, oh, this is expensive stuff, okay, as a grocery store. There are actually never any lines, and the cashier has a little apron on, male or female, and there's no conveyor belt. You know, when you go to a grocery store, you plop your own stuff on the belt, right?
Right.
And they hit some button and it goes along. There is actually none in a Gelson store. The person actually takes it out of the basket for you. You never even empty your own basket. It's absolutely stunning to me. And if you were to go down the cereal aisle, if someone were to buy a box of Cheerios, I swear to God, there's got to be a video somewhere where someone bought some Cheerios, get that replaced immediately. I mean, you just never see holes in the shelf. It's a piece of artwork. It's just absolutely magnificent. And other than the fact that it's just too expensive at the time to go there all the time, I went there enough to get my fix of retail at a high level. Folks, get your stores perfect. Take the store, divide it up by the number of salespeople you have. So if you have 5 salespeople, get 5 sections. Give each person a section that they're responsible for 30 days and then rotate it. So I have section 1 this month. Next month, I'll have section 2. It gets salespeople in touch with their own section and create an opportunity for them to help you make it perfect, to look after things that are selling that maybe we didn't really catch, to make sure the holes are filled, that the merchandise, the shelves are faced off, and that merchandise that it's abused or wrong gets off the floor and fixed. Let's get this door. Let's get the light bulbs out of the sockets and clean. No tape buggers on the top of the of displays or walls where you took down memos in 1936, and you know the monofilament that's still hanging from the last sign that you had up there, and things that are faded. And let's get the store looking right and keep it maintained that way. It costs nothing to keep it right. It only costs a lot of money when you've let it go into such despair that you have to really, really get it right. And this is part of my management training. We do these massive cleanups in organization. People say, well, when are we going to get on to sales training? And my answer is always the same. As soon as I know that you're disciplined enough to actually accept sales training, we'll give it to you. But until then, we're going to become a disciplined organization. So as I look around the world and I see people on the floor re-merchandising shelves but refusing to say hello to customers, when I see people disengaged from a disciplined point of view, I know there's a huge issue. So to me, it is a battle, operations versus sales. And the answer is simple. Get your operations out of the way, get on the floor and sell. I like all operational duties, tasks, and responsibilities to be done prior to the store opening. I actually schedule people and pay them to get there early to merchandise. And in larger organizations, we actually have operational teams where they start work sometimes at 4 o'clock in the morning in larger organizations. And their day is from four to opening, get the shelves restocked, merchandise moved, all that stuff. And then starting at store opening, they're preparing merchandise for the next day. Operational teams are much more efficient than having salespeople do it, so forth and so on. Anyway, that's the idea. It was a long lecture. I've now worn myself out.
Okay, well, to recap, the sales versus operations, get your operations right, get your store cleaned, get your stuff organized, get it merchandised well. And these are all prerequisites to the training, the sales training that you're going to put everybody through. And it's creating the discipline on the front end to make sure that we can have discipline through the sales process as well.
And there's a final thought here, because there always is a final thought, because I can't be done with anything because it's an ongoing process for me. There's also systems. There's systems. So the systems of bringing in the merchandising, displaying it, selling it, accounting for it, all those things are systems and processes, using the register, how you mark things, all those little systems. And those have to be drilled insanely. You drill them, do it again, do it again, do it again. And then after a while, it becomes habit to people. So I never want to be at the effect of someone's inability to ring up a sale that's a complex transaction, or a special order, or how to return merchandise to the back room, or any of those things. I want that drilled to within an inch of anybody's life before we talk about sales. And there's no burden anymore. There's no distractions anymore. Now that we prepared for war, let's go to war. And war, by the way, is winning at retail.
You've been listening to Retail Revisited. If our conversation today inspired you, please be sure to rate us on iTunes or share us with your friends. You can see a full list of all our episodes at thefriedmangroup.com. And for more information on how the Friedman Group can transform your business, you can contact us at sales@thefriedmangroup.com. A special thanks to Harry J. Friedman for sharing his 35 years of unbelievable experience for all of us to hear.